Hey, welcome back to Invisible Machines. I'm a congested Josh Tyson, a contributing editor here at UX Magazine, and I'm joined again by resident visionary Rob Wilson, CEO and co-founder of OneReach.ai. Rob and I are co-authors of the best-selling book Age of Invisible Machines, and this podcast is where we continue our explorations of agentic AI. With 2025 just about in the books, Rob and I are looking back at the conversations we've had this year with some of the biggest and brightest folks working in this space and offering up our predictions for agentic AI in 2026. With major disruptive forces like outbound AI in the hands of consumers, explosions in simulation, and agent runtime environments enabling organizations to scale AI agents, next year will likely bring seismic changes to the ways investors look at companies and the ways companies look at themselves. Rob and I will be showing a few examples of our predictions, so you should watch this episode on Spotify or YouTube. We're also going to share sneak peeks at upcoming episodes with returning guest Ben Gertzel of SingularityNet and Joshua Gans, co-author of Prediction Machines. You'll hear us referencing IDWs in this episode. This is the acronym for Intelligent Digital Workers, which are essentially a user interface into an agent runtime environment. With that, we wish you a happy new year and invite you to share our vision for the next 12 months of agentic AI. All right, Rob, I've called you here today because we have a mission. We're going to run through some predictions today for 2026. A lot of these ideas have come up from the conversations that we've had this year on the podcast. So I thought to start us off, maybe we could talk a little bit about outbound AI and how you see that morphing in 2026. We were sort of surprised not to see it rear its head this year, like in the form of maybe a disgruntled customer chaining together some agents and hounding a company's call center because they didn't get a rebate. But what do you think?
I think a lot of it's happening, not quite being talked about yet. It's like it's happening quietly. Well, before we jump into that, I think it's valuable to like kind of reference our conversation with Ben Gertzel. And I'm hearing this a lot from a lot of different folks that are innovators in the space. The capital is not going to discovering new ways to use AI. Most of the capital is going to scaling the innovations that have already happened. So it seems to be that money goes to scaling, not to invention. And in a systemic sort of way, in a system-oriented way, nothing was learned from OpenAI. In that OpenAI was just a dream, an idea. It had no explicit path to creating a LLM or a ChatGPT. It certainly had a number of ideas that it was going to explore, but it was very much so a research approach, just like OneReach. In a similar path, like both found a way to create something that's commercially viable. Obviously, LLMs, a lot more capital, and as a result, a lot more revenue. Took $1 billion to train the thing. But what I do find now is most of the capital that's going into AI now is leveraging, you know, that those LLMs. And we see like other companies like Anthropic and Grok, and the list goes on, just sort of replicating the same approach. And hence, like, we have sort of the same models, just like racing and, you know, slightly doing better on the evals than the next one. But we don't have this fundamental exploration, this sort of dreamer component. And I can see it myself. Like I can see that, you know, whenever I talk about runtimes and agent runtimes.
We'll get into those in a minute.
Yeah. They don't have like necessarily an appetite for it. You know, everybody's still trying to figure out how to scale and utilize the LLM and the approach to training the LLM. But you don't see a lot going into like rethinking how these things should work. So as we get into 2026, it's really interesting because I think we'll see a lot of evolution on what's been invented. But it's very hard to say, are we going to come up with a new way of reasoning? Are we going to see a big jump and a leap in 2026 like we've seen in the past? And the answer is like, not if you like follow the money. You know, most of the money in 2026 is going to go into scaling and not rethinking. Yeah, that's Ben's like a great example because that's what he's trying to do, is rethink the whole model.
Should we share a clip
from Ben? So,
sure.
All right. This is a preview, as it were, of our conversation with Ben Gertzel from SingularityNet.
Fortunately, there's crazy folks like us who can. We're not too big to fail, right? Like we're going to take wild and crazy risks on different ways of doing things.
Yeah, and that's cool. What you're bringing up is a good point, that there's still space for you to keep innovating, and
a lot of space. Yeah. And that is without going all God bless America. Like that is a beautiful thing, a good old or bad old USA, right? There is that. Things are not that well organized, and things are very harsh if you happen to be born without much money. So there are many bad things in US. On the other hand, we still have freedom of speech, freedom of the press by and large. And we have the best entrepreneurial environment in the world for all the shitty things about it. We even have a fairly open environment for crypto now, which is one of the few good things. So, there is space, and there's ability to explore all different ways of doing things and to pull together modest amounts of money to do out there stuff. I mean, the vast chunks of money are going to Me Too approaches and just imitating whatever seems to have made someone a lot of money most recently, right? And the vast majority of resources are going into that. But still, we're in an abundant enough time that you can still cobble together modest amounts of resources to do stuff out of the main street.
Yeah. So Ben summed it up nicely. And do you see some of that sort of scrappy stuff that he's talking about coming in the form of outbound AI?
No, I'd say that what we're seeing with outbound AI is leveraging what's already been created, meaning what we've created already, what exists, what we're scaling right now, is fully capable of going outbound, right? And when I say outbound, I just want to be clear. Next year is going to be the year of, let's call it invisible work. If we have invisible machines as a book, we think next year is sort of the beginning of visible work. And this is this idea that we have at the moment when we sort of trigger AI to do things, even with coding, we're in this sort of request response mode. A human requests something, they get an answer. Then the human requests something, it thinks, it goes through a chain of thought, talks to itself a little bit, comes back and gives you an answer. And then it's like this iterating. So we could call it like very heavy human loop component. Yeah. Kind of very dependent on humans for it to get its work done. But what we're seeing now is systems that are fully capable of getting work done on their own, being able to test themselves, evaluate themselves. So if the system can make something, it can evaluate the thing it's making. And we realize that, simulation and testing is sort of this next hurdle. And that's what we're going to see a lot of next year. But the implications of that is going to be profound, because what we're going to end up doing is agents that are doing invisible work on consumers' behalf, on employees' behalf, just out there applying for jobs, out there, lobbying for better rates on their car insurance. Like, the list will go on and on and on, as it's just doing our bidding for us, even as simple as like planning things and organizing parties and whatever invisible work we can dream up will just be snoozing away in bed while it's just cranking off hours where the electricity is cheapest, and just trying to, I would say, like, game the system on our behalf. The question for a person is, should you ever not be looking for another job? Mathematically, the answer is, if it doesn't get in the way of doing your current job, the answer is you should never not be looking for another job. There's always a better job. There's always a better opportunity. And what if you could have some machine do that on your behalf 24/7? And then it's going to come down to, like, do you want that many job interviews? But I think the answer is it will provide a lot of services around that, because what's going to happen on the other side of the coin with companies is the panic buying side, where they're going to be like, well, I'm going to need AI to field all these resumes. And so what we're going to see is a lot of vetting going on before two humans even talk to each other, a lot of interaction.
But those sort of like panic buys that companies do often end up being bolt-on solutions, point solutions. And that was sort of another shift that we had discussed. I mean, maybe we've been waiting for it to happen for a while. It's been kind of slower growing than we had expected. But
yeah, then,
but this idea of companies embracing systemic change.
Yeah, this is what people don't understand. It's not that companies are not adopting AI. They're adopting AI at a massive rate. It's just not top down. It's very bottom up. And there's no question that tons and tons of HR folks are putting resumes in ChatGPT if they don't have a tool provided by their company to do this, and using it to qualify them for the position. It's already happening, right? The benefit to the company is that by doing it this way, the human is taking responsibility for the agent's work, right? And that's what the company wants, right? The company wants a human to be responsible for this. So whether or not, you know, that employee is doing it with the permission of the company or whether they're just doing it on the side, what the company gets is a person to be held accountable if there's a mistake made or if something goes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just because the company itself hasn't figured out how to provide that framework, the systemic change that would allow that to be more institutionalized, right? So what we have is this sort of awkward way of doing it where a person dumps it in ChatGPT, ChatGPT overlooks something or hallucinates, makes a mistake. That person doesn't double check. Then they're called out and they can't blame the AI and get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way the company wants it right now. So what's the company going to do? Potentially they'll let go of more employees, kind of forcing the existing employees into that paradigm, right? So they'll say, well, you know, we need to start laying off to give shareholders the impression that we're adopting AI. And so we're going to go ahead and start reducing our headcount. It's going to force those employees into using AI that aren't, but then they're going to find themselves in this place where they're accountable for what the AI does. And I think we'll see a lot of that in 2026. We'll see, you know, these layoffs continue. You know, I kind of see it as a two-step process for companies. They sort of look for ways to free up money so they can invest in AI. And so they sort of do the layoff before the automation. I think we all imagine the right thing to do is to invest in the automation, capitalize it, and then rearrange people into more appropriate roles. But a lot of companies don't have that lab, they don't have that capital. So
yeah,
we're in this interesting place where, you know, companies are being valued on their profit margins. So they're having to be very lean. And so they have to find ways to free up this money. And it's kind of a leap of faith now that they lay off a bunch of people and hope that this stuff gets automated effectively in their absence. There's a lot of issues with that. Knowledge goes out the door. You know, one of the nice things about doing it in a way that's more thoughtful and where you get the automation in place first is you get to transfer that knowledge and make sure that, you know, it doesn't go out the door. So you think of our NASA conversation, right? There's a lot of information that has left NASA now because it was never captured, right?
Locked away in people's heads.
Yeah. So I think we'll see a lot more of that, where panic buying is what I start to imagine more towards the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to cause a lot of failure and mistakes with companies as they've been a little bit too lackadaisical about building internal capabilities around this. I think we'll see also a trend towards contractors being sort of exposed. There's a lot of people who talk about or give advice on AI in theory, but don't actually, you know, it's in the one reach world, right? Where you're an expert in agentic AI if you've released at least 10 production deployments. There's very few people in the world that can say they've done that many. There's a lot more people giving advice on agentic AI right now than there are people who have launched 10 by a long shot.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think this year will be a year of it being kind of obvious to people, those who have actually done it and are working in it and those who talk about it. And I think where it will be most expressed is in companies that hire consultants to come in to help them with this, to find out that the consultants know as much as they do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's going to be a big mistake. I think a lot of companies are going to not be okay with that, because it will become clear to them that they need to learn this stuff internally.
Yeah.
That paying to teach a consultant and investing in a consultant's learning, especially the mistakes that they're going to make, and then not walking out the door.
Knowledge leaving.
Yeah, you have to institutionalize that stuff. So I think we'll just see kind of an exposing of people that have been sort of jumping on the bandwagon. Kind of parroting some of the words out there, but not actually in it.
Yeah, and that scenario you describe with a consultant isn't necessarily emblematic of the kind of culture shift that it's come up a lot this year on the podcast. Like, a big piece of this is a culture shift, but then there's also the technical side of it, which, like, the missing piece for systemic change is kind of this runtime concept, right? Like, having that execution environment where you can start building and experimenting and looking at feedback loops and figuring out guardrails and security, like, where all that stuff is sort of around you and at your disposal.
Yeah, we had a meeting recently. It gives me a lot of hope. This is one consulting company. It's a smaller one, relatively unknown, but very high profile people. And mm-hmm. they're leaning into this heavily. And their lead architect, you know, had sort of sat down and really imagined what a runtime environment needs to be, you know, just itemizing all of the things. I mean, it was a long, long list of, from event management to canonical knowledge, like just listing, boom, 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 you know, everything mm-hmm. that they felt needed to exist in an environment before ever building a single agent. Like, we need all of this in place.
Yeah.
And then we could build our agent. And that gave me hope, because what I could see was that that there are people that are thinking about this in a concrete way. And that's why I think runtimes are going to be a big part of 2026, because if you're talking about agents and you're not talking about the runtime, if you're talking about the agent, it's clear that it's one of the sort of litmus tests for, do you do this in practice or in theory? If you're talking about building an agent or pre-created agents or anything around the creation or capabilities of agents, then you're sort of off track. If you're talking about the infrastructure that needs to be in place before you even get to any of those things, then you're probably actually trying to do it, or you've tried to do it and you realize building agents is so far down the road. It'd be sort of like designing and building WordPerfect or a Microsoft Word application before thinking about the computer or the operating system that it's going to run mm-hmm. on. You know, there's no discussion about the fundamental infrastructure and software architecture that it needs to be housed in.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's try this. Let's try and give people a look at some different aspects of a runtime. I have some things to share here. So this is familiar to you, Rob, and to some listeners. This is the invisible machine that we created as a digital companion to our book. And what you have here on this side, on the right, there's a feed. Right now, it's got a lot of content relating to podcasts that we've produced, podcasts that you've been on. But you could imagine if this IDW as sort of a portal into a runtime, like if you were part of a team at an organization sharing an IDW, this might be one of the interfaces you use. It could be your primary interface. And, you know, on the right here, you would probably have pieces of content relating to your work. And then here you'd have a conversation panel where you could talk to your IDW. And then you might have like a history that shows some of the projects you've been working on with your IDW. So this IDW is essentially becoming an expert in agentic AI. It's trained on our book. I interact with it a fair amount. I was having conversations with it actually about lean knowledge management, Roger Forsgren's approach to knowledge management that he used at NASA, and how that relates to the space feature reduction model that you came up with for the second edition of our book. So then what I'm going to show you next here is a knowledge model. As I mentioned, the IDW that we were looking at before is becoming more and more of an expert in agentic AI.
Yeah, and a lot of people might like oversimplify this, think we're like showing just RAG. This is a narrow model. This is a This is everything from fine-tuned to RAG to graph. It's a full model. If we're going to have canonical ideas and canonical knowledge, you need a layer on top of a generically trained LLM. And you can call it alignment, right? Because I think it's the best way to think about it. But you're creating alignment around specific domain of knowledge. So in this particular case, we're collecting knowledge. We're splitting it into ideas. These ideas become cards. And anytime anything changes within that idea, those cards are going to be updated versus having duplicate ideas that conflict within the same knowledge. So what we're doing is we're reconciling like a single source of truth for an idea. We do this with CRMs and databases, right? A CRM is a canonical truth for somebody's email address or their name or their physical address, right? And we keep those up to date. Well, this is a similar idea, but it's canonical knowledge for concepts. So you might have like locations of your company, and they may be cards that describe each location and the ideas behind like why that location was chosen and what it's good for and who works there. This is all concepts that are going to change over time. And so you want to make sure that who works there is not duplicated, and you don't have like a version of that from last month and last year all baked into the same corpus of knowledge. You want to make sure that that's unique and in a single source of truth. And that's what's happening here. And typically, you know, in organizations, and there's very few organizations other than like ones like NASA that have done this over the course of the last 10 years or 20 years. And then the reason is because it tends to be like highly skilled and very laborious to maintain a knowledge base. But in this particular case, we've automated all of that using AI. And so now you can sort of have the knowledge base that NASA uses structured the same way they do, in fact, even better. And that's not by my view, that's Roger's view, who basically created the way NASA does it. even have it better. And it's all managed by AI, and it's keeping it up to date. And I think a lot of people don't understand that agentic AI starts with knowledge. If you're going to train an agent to do something, the first thing you do is train it to know something. It's the same with a person. You know, if a person starts in a company to do a job, even to, like answer the phone, the first thing you're going to do isn't teach them how to use the phone. The first thing you're going to do is give them the knowledge they need to answer the questions that they need to answer. And then you're going to teach them to answer the phone. It's the same here. If you're going to build an agent, like build the agent's knowledge first, then build the agent that does something, and it will use that knowledge to do it. What's great about this is once you build this expert and this canonical domain of knowledge, you can start building agents upon agents upon agents. So think about this, like if I'm Patagonia and I have a product, right? It's a wetsuit, and I create an expert on that wetsuit, knows everything about that wetsuit from where the materials are sourced, when to use it, what millimeter length or thickness. Now I can create agents that can manage supply chain, pricing, stocking shelves, answering questions to customers, answering internal questions to employees. Like the list of agents now are endless, but they all depend on this knowledge.
Yeah, that same source of truth knowledge. Yeah, and in this case, it was sort of a collaborative process with AI. Like I took transcripts from our podcast episodes, generated summaries that I then went through and looked at myself and checked and rewrote and then put them right into this knowledge model. And it sorted out like the different ideas. It built some initial connections, and then it is sort of this collaborative process where you're going through and reading each note, verifying the information. So then I'm saying that, yeah, it's okay to use, and then it becomes like a core part of the model. So you can imagine something like this existing for a company, giving agents a source of truth they can go to. If I go back to our book IDW, let's take a look at the skills. So if I was on a team and I was using this IDW, I might want to use some of these skills. skills for managing knowledge, reporting. These are ones that are just assigned to this book IDW, but there really is a whole huge shared library of skills that exist in the OneReach platform that would then, you know, allow you to kind of customize things for teams. Let's look really quick too at what kind of an agent flow might look like. I believe this one, I did not build this. it was shared to me by the IDW team, but this is actually, I think, the flow that it's like a multi-agent flow that the knowledge model uses to share information.
A lot of people can misunderstand how this works. I think the important realization is that agents are always going to be like part code and part generative. Think of what generative AI brought to the table. It was sort of like we had half a brain for computers, right? The logical half. And we'd give it these instructions and it would follow those instructions. What we were missing was the other half of the brain, which is to plan, to think about how to make a decision, what decisions to make, to evaluate. And so it's not the end of code as we know it. It's the beginning of like a complete brain, right? Which is every solution is going to be, to one degree or another, some part symbolic code and some part generative.
So like a blend of deterministic and probabilistic.
Exactly, yeah. And that's what you're seeing here. The other thing that's important is that, especially on the back end, when it comes to decision-making, as we defer decisions to these systems, some human is going to have to sign off on its decision-making process. This kind of comes back to the humans deciding and taking responsibility for the things that agents make. This is the formal way. This is like the informal way is what I said. Someone's going to use an LLM. They're not going to tell their boss. And if it makes a mistake, they're going to get fired. This is where the organization approves the process, where this employee can preview the decision-making process for the agent and approve its decision-making process. And anyone else in the organization can also see and be part of this process. And that will create continuity of decision. Like, now we institutionalize the building of agents and the use of AI within an organization versus the Wild West that we have today.
Yeah. And the things that you're discussing, like kicking a decision to a person or having another agent evaluate one agent's output, like those all become steps. And this looks like a tree, but it's really kind of more of a loop.
So when we see this, you know, a lot of people see a flow chart, but it's really a decision-making chart for an agent.
All right, Rob, so you did mention invisible work earlier. You have something to show us, right? You're going to show us kind of what invisible work doesn't look like?
Yeah.
Shall we say?
Yeah, I think it's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing for people to kind of to imagine it. And then it's a whole other thing to see it. So let's see it.
Okay.
So this is, in this particular case, I'm talking about an agent that actually builds applications. Now, whether it's building an application, whether it's managing a project, creating a document, building websites, or you name it, it's all going to essentially operate in the same paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
It could be out there trying to get me a deal on something. So I'm going to show, like, now that I have my runtime, I'm going to show what an agent sort of looks like that's doing invisible work and what interfaces might look like for managing agents that do invisible work. So I'm just going to open this space up here. I'm not going to get too deep into what a space is and why you need it, but what we have here is its memory. We talk about constitutional memory. We've talked a lot about this reference memory. This is canonical knowledge, like you expressed before. Over here, we have in context. This is the information it's taking into account with each action that it's doing. And then episodic memory is more of a history of the things it's done and the things it wants to do in the future. And over here, I've got a budget. So this is a project cost. I can set some sort of limit. Let's say I only want to spend $10 on this. So I cap it out and I say, look, you have a $10 budget. the quality of what this thing's going to do is going to be dictated by the number of tokens or the capital that I give it, right?
This is cool because you've talked about this throughout the season, this example in particular of being able to just have an idea and send an agent out to do it on a budget.
Exactly. So now I can define the idea here. I'll help you set up this project. It needs a project vision, a journey map, a style guide. And so it's going to create the MVP and the to-do list. And this test project is just a project for our podcast. This was just a calendar for scheduling a podcast and an agent that's going to help us with scheduling, getting the guests, all the internal stuff we need to do, the preps, the timelines, right? And so I'm like, okay, I want to create an agent that helps us manage the podcast. Now, this is a little bit meta because I'm an agent creating an agent, right? And that's sort of interesting in itself. But what we have up here is the meta learning cycle. And what's going to happen here when I hit play is it's going to go through a series of steps from evaluating what it has already, because I have already gone through a version, right? So now I want to do a second version, a second pass at this. And it's going to do its research. It's going to evaluate from the information I've provided, user feedback, etc. It's going to do some research as to how best to formulate and consume that initial evaluation. And then it's going to plan out the steps and the different processes that it's going to need to get the work done. So it's going to create its own to-do list. Then it's going to execute that, which means it's going to code this app out and do all the things it needs to do. And then it's going to test itself. So it's going to go through clicking all the buttons, making sure it all works. It's even potentially going to go out to actual humans and have them evaluate and test and gather that feedback. And once all the testing feedback has been gathered, then it's going to iterate and make those improvements. All of this with human in the loop, like I can make decisions along the way if I want, or not, or just let it roll. And then it's going to make those improvements, incorporate those in, and then it's going to finalize that into a release. And if I click this button here and turn that on, it'll continue going to version 3, and it'll keep iterating on this application until I max out my budget. And so all I have to do now is just hit play, and it's going to now do all of those things, and I can walk away, and I can now go set up another 100 of these things. And the next one I could put in, you know, find the best deal on car insurance, right? So instead of building an app, it's going to go out there, it's going to plan, it's going to evaluate, and it's going to, and I'm going to give it a budget. You know, there's no reason to spend more money than it will save me, right? and so I might say for $10 or for $20, it's worth seeing if they can get a better deal, and it's going to potentially email companies, get quotes, surf the web, possibly even look on message boards and talk to other people to see what they get. This thing is fully capable of thinking well beyond itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so off it goes. And what that's going to look like is I'm just going to wake up in the morning and it's going to post its progress here in my feed, and any decisions it needs me to make. Like, oh, I got some feedback. Somebody suggested we add this feature. I can approve that in the feed. So I'm still in the loop. It's working away. It's going to update me on progress to budget. Each time that it completes a version, it'll let me know. It'll let me know what changed. So I'm here. And that's the same for all 100 I might have going at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be here and aware and able to make decisions. And over here, I'll be able to ask questions, find out where they're at. Hey, how's it going with X, Y, or Z project? And this is really a new way of thinking about how we might get work done. So
it's like legitimate multitasking.
Yeah. It really is.
It's so interesting. You can imagine, like we were talking about canonical knowledge, like if this was like a personal agent or IDW that someone had, that canonical knowledge could be a secure database of all sorts of information about them and their family. The agent would have like select access to be able to bring certain information into its quest to go find car insurance, like any sort of information that might give it an advantage or like a way to find a better price. Then the next wrinkle, and this is something I think that we've talked about that probably will accelerate in 2026 as well, and that's this idea of agents as buyers. So so agents with wallets. So even in a situation like you're showing, that that is sort of an agent with a wallet. You've given it credits to execute this task, but there's also just a lot of consumer facing versions of that too, where, you know, you might have an IDW that shops on your behalf for certain things, and it knows that you've given it a certain amount of money to spend. Sometimes it might use it all, sometimes it might not use it all, but you know it's always going to find like the best deal. And that's sort of this whole different area of operations across the board. I mean, I think even of marketing, so much of marketing now is based on appealing to human emotion, but agents don't have emotions. So if you're trying to pitch a product to an agent, that looks a lot different than if you're trying to market it to a human.
Yeah. Yep. And I think that, you know, once we see that runtimes, you know, that folks are just installing these things, they realize like now they'll just be building agents that have these guardrails, that have, you know, this trust from the human, then you're right. Like once you trust this thing enough to make purchases and you've given it a budget and you said, yeah, go buy ink for my printer whenever I run out. And you can just talk to the printer to find out, off we go. And, you know, as you mentioned, when we were looking at the canonical knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's always learning and it's always consuming new information. It could be monitoring an email box, your email box. It could be monitoring a Slack channel. It could be monitoring the web. And so like, you know, you could set up your printer to send your IDW an email when it's low on ink. You don't have to actually connect the printer to the IDW in some sort of, you know, API way.
Yeah.
You can just simply have the printer send an email when it's low on ink, and then the agent will just add that into its context, and off it goes. So it's just going to be sitting there waiting to do work, and it'll have nothing to do until that email comes in, and then it'll be like, okay, it's time to go get ink, go order it, for the progress of its delivery, and ensure that you're going to be home to get it. And, you know, and this is where we get agents talking to other agents and why runtimes matter so much, because it's got to make sure you're going to be there when ink arrives. And then that's going to be some other agent that monitors your calendar, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so like making sure that stuff's in there. So anyway, that's runtimes, and I think that's invisible work, and I think that's 2026. That's going to explode on the employee and customer side first, and then we're going to see this sort of later coming in with companies starting to trust them more.
Yeah. We had a conversation with Joshua Gans, who is one of the co-authors of Prediction Machines,
mm-hmm.
which is a book that you've referenced several times this season. It came out several years ago, but you know, you've talked about how it really is very relevant right now. And as we were exploring his new book and some of his work, we sort of dug into this idea of systemic change, the way that it might emerge through these agentic systems, sort of flattening the middle of companies. And
mm-hmm.
that also affects the way that shareholders are looking to make investments. Shareholders, I don't know if it'll happen as soon as 2026, but it's not hard to imagine a world where investors aren't so excited in companies that aren't using runtimes or embracing systemic change, because where's the long-term viability of an organization that's living in another era?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, let's share a little bit of that conversation with Joshua Gans.
Sure.
That'll be coming out in the new year. We were getting ready for this conversation and looking at your new work. One idea that kept coming up that was really fascinating to us was sort of this hidden secret about AI adoption, almost that almost like the people that are gonna have to pick the systems to automate work inside of companies are in some ways almost like selecting their usurper. That a lot of this work eliminates the friction at the middle management level and sort of starts to flatten that layer. And while that is obviously scary for people working in middle management, it doesn't necessarily mean less work to do. It just means like kind of a new atmosphere for working in.
I think, well, so one of the tensions has always been, you know, this happens on multiple levels. One is, of course, how the AI is going to learn to do jobs or tasks. They're going to have to learn it from someone. and so if they're going to be learning it from you, do you want to train them? That's an issue. That would be an issue if you're training an underling as well. So it's not a new problem. There's also, you know, a general set of issues, and this is not unique to AI, which is when you get these new technologies within an organization, there are going to be winners and losers. And the problem is that, for want of a better term, lead you sort of to political problems. You get disgruntledment, aggrieved people. And those aggrieved people, you talked about frictions before, can cause frictions in an organization. And so, AI seems to have all of those characteristics in spades. And so we'd expect that adjustment's a difficult process. Now, in other places where that's been resolved is you have startups starting from scratch without all that historical baggage, adopting these things and building up sort of AI-first approaches in different industries. I don't know whether we're going to see that or not. It doesn't always happen that way. That's the traditional way in which sort of a market economy deals with some of these this inertia that comes at that level.
I think the interesting thing about that and the takeaway for me is we're going to see a lot of the tools coming out that enable people to do this invisible work. You know, we're going to see a lot of point solutions, though. So something that like gets you out of a parking ticket or, disputes a medical bill and, things that you just defer out. There's work you defer out to somebody else who's sort of programmed it, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we'll see a lot of that, and we'll see a lot of mistakes, a lot of issues with that. And, by the end of the year, we'll start to see that people want transparency. They're not going to buy pre-built agents where the logic and the decision-making is hidden.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to want to see behind the scenes because they're going to understand they're responsible for what the thing does, irrespective of whether or not it was done by an AI or them.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to take responsibility, we're going to want to see what decision criteria it's using, what value algorithms it has for it to make those decisions and sign off on those. So I think we'll see a lot of pre-created bots in the beginning of the year, and then we'll see a kind of a big push away from anything that's, whether it's symbolic code, just regular good old code. We'll want to see like open source becomes critical because we want to see how code's making decisions, or whether it's prompts and system prompts, like all the way we're going to see by the end of the year, transparency being like a big hot topic, along with, of course, simulation.
Yeah. And I think too, it just, again, rings out that if we're expecting AI to provide these deeply personal experiences for people, or personalized experiences rather, security is just paramount. Like, in order to have an agent effectively do things, I mean, buying car insurance is maybe a little low stakes, but like there's so many things. Like, I would love to have an agent help me with my taxes or something like that, but like that kind of stuff, you're not just going to willy-nilly throw information into a system and hope it pays your taxes and doesn't sell your information to the highest bidder or anything like that,
Yeah, and you're not gonna buy into a decision-making criteria that you don't see that could be biased.
Mm-hmm.
Think of like the advertiser model, right? Where you get the service for free, paid for by the advertiser. Mm-hmm. Like, you imagine that you had a decision-making agent that was paid for by advertisers.
Yeah. That's one flavor of dystopia right there.
Yeah, like how the hell did I end up with all of these owls, using the...
The David Sedaris, yeah.
The David Sedaris quote.
Yeah, only dimension of telling your relatives that you like owls.
Yes, yes. You're like, all of a sudden, I told my AI I like owls and, it's been ordering owls on Amazon. So, I'm not using Amazon agents to make purchasing decisions. There's just zero chance of that. So the next big area I really feel is going to be a huge topic of conversation for 2026 is going to be simulation. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be bigger than agents themselves as a thing, whether it's, robots being able to learn because we've simulated physics in a virtual world and they're able to learn without destroying the environment they're in.
Mm-hmm.
Or whether that's just simply agents being able to simulate conversations with people Software testing processes, simulating companies making decisions, predicting outcomes. This is going to provide the trust that's needed with these, you know, narrow symbolic systems. And
yeah.
So I think next year we'll hear a lot of conversation ramping up about compute from NVIDIA, et cetera, all around simulation and providing agentic AI with environments that they can practice on.
Yeah, and we learned in our conversation at the beginning of this season with Stephen Witt that like NVIDIA's like, they're looking heavily into simulation, sounded like primarily like physical simulation, like you mentioned, like making sure a robot can do the dishes without breaking them, right? Like letting it wash dishes in some sort of simulated environment. But if we're thinking about runtimes and things like canonical knowledge and even like digital twins, you have this whole new environment where you can talk about invisible work. You can be running simulations all day long about how any sort of investment or decision might play out in the next 10 minutes or 10 years. Like you can
exactly.
You could do so much.
Even with software systems. Software systems can simulate testing themselves. They can simulate if it's an employee onboarding experience. They can simulate being an employee and interacting with it. They can simulate what happens if one of the systems it depends on goes down. What happens if, you know, their manager gets sick while they're onboarding? What happens if they quit, you know, halfway through the onboarding? Like this can all be stuff that's simulated in the same way that I just showed you, right? There was a whole testing component to that. It's easy to underestimate how versatile that can be and will be as we start moving from getting these systems to do things to, especially like coding, right? We look at how well does it code. We're going to start looking at how well do these systems test the code that they make.
Yeah. Well, it's funny too, because we had talked a bit about like investors looking at investments differently, looking at companies differently. And if you're thinking about investing in two companies and one of them has this incredible simulation game happening where they're like predicting outcomes constantly and then the other one doesn't, the choice is pretty clear.
Yeah, which one's going to make more mistakes? Which one's going to make better choices, better decisions? Yeah. Which you know, employees are going to have more data to make better decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's an unfair advantage, quite frankly. It's just, you know, it's just like you said, there'll be winners and losers. And I know that's like an overstated thing. But I think in this particular instance, it's going to be very, very true.
Yeah. Maybe next year we'll start to see that investors are, you know, because as Ben kind of alluded to, like there's a lot of money pouring into copying things and just trying that's already been done. But this systemic change element is making these powerful tools and into an environment where they can actually do really impressive things.
Yeah, we already see the shareholder pressure to get companies to invest in AI, whether that's product companies trying to sell AI to other folks or companies consuming AI to reduce cost. And it seems to be like all about to drive better efficiency within the organization. I think we'll start to see like efficiency is one aspect of it, but as they start employing this stuff, like doing more than just cutting costs. And I think we're in this phase where companies are sort of, they're making the choice to save money and lay off people, but it's kind of before the automation is in place. And kind of, as I said earlier, now it's going to be, what are you going to do with that savings? You know, it's one thing shareholders pressuring to create that savings, but then if they don't invest in AI or those investments aren't effective because they don't invest them properly, then I think we're going to have real problems because you have folks walking out the door, you have knowledge walking out the door, your capabilities are, you know, there's going to be ramifications to that. And if you don't back it up with actually adoption, you just sort of save money. I think of Verizon in this case, right? Where new leadership comes in, they make some bold changes. I mean, I hate to see people get laid off, but it's also impressive to make that kind of change in an organization that quickly and that's that old. And then you see that you know, they're going to save, you know, 15,000 employees, biggest layoff in the history of Verizon. They're going to free up a lot of money. And I think the objective for them is clear. It's that they've been losing new subscribers, you know, to like T-Mobile and others. And So it's not that they're doing it because they want to. They're doing it because they have to. They need a solution. They're, you know, people aren't signing up for Verizon. That's a problem for them. Now the question is, do they take that money they saved and put it into deals for end consumers to get free iPhones so that they get new subscribers and they get that subscriber base up? Or do they put it into AI and efficiency and drive the business costs down even further and become more efficient as an organization so they can, you know, continue to give away iPhones or whatever else it takes? And I think that's what investors are going to start looking for, is once you free up that capital, can you? That's hard. Companies are showing that, you know, there are many companies showing they can make those hard choices. The next thing, though, will be, what are you going to do with that? And do you know how to invest that in AI? Is that just, you know, sort of a short-term win that's going to have, you know, negative ramifications a year or 2 years down the road?
Well, I feel like I've been seeing more chatter, too, about less focus on automation necessarily and more focus on enablement, which sort of lines up with what we were talking about, employees bringing this technology into the company because they're just using it on their own. If you think about that, it can be more of an enablement tool. The infrastructure is not in place really to create meaningful automations right now, but there is a wealth of opportunity for enablement. And some of that enablement ends up kind of leading to systemic change if the balance is right, if the culture is right, if the tech stack's right, and that sort of thing.
I've always said that in our industry, if you're going to buy AI from someone, make sure they're using it to run their company. Have them show you how they use AI within their organization. Man, I say that and I can't believe how few people do it. I don't see people going out there and asking to be shown this.
Yeah.
And now I don't care if you're Google or Amazon. Like, it's very clear that how they use it internally is very limited. It's very sparse. And so if you wanted to automate your company and you're going to go to someone who hasn't automated theirs, don't expect that their technology is going to get you there. It's that litmus test, right? Are you real? And I think that's super, super key in the upcoming years, is there's going to be a lot of hype.
Yeah, because whether it's a company or a consultant, you don't want to be in the position of paying someone else to help them figure out.
Yeah.
How to improve their business, and it's not really like trickling down to you. So,
yes.
All right. Well, I mean, 2025, boy, it went by fast.
Boy, did it. Yeah.
But I'm definitely looking forward to more of these conversations next year. So thanks, Rob.
Absolutely.
It's been fun. All right. Well, thanks for hanging out with us again here on Invisible Machines. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Always remember that you can watch this podcast too on our Invisible Machines YouTube channel. Head over to uxmag.com. We have a podcast page there where you can explore our back catalog and you can look at episodes centered around popular topics. Many, many thanks to our incredible production team here in the U.S. and in Ukraine, Elias Parker, Michael Litvinov, Allison Harshberger, Alla Slesarenko, Vera Pokotkov, and Darina Moskovchuk. Till next week, Owagi.